the rest of the morning. And we do have a quorum, I've been informed, so Representative Johnson, would you entertain a motion to approve the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I so move.
Motion by Johnson to approve the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Against, same sign. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Again, today we mentioned is Dairy Day. We also have one bill on the agenda. That bill deals with the topic of interest to agrotourism. So if you want to stay here following the Dairy Day's festivities and see a bill in committee, why we invite you to do that as well. And again, maybe some of the pages could work on passing around the goodies and such up on the cooler up to the left side of the testifiers' table. And we certainly again say thank you to those that provided the treats this morning for Dairy Day here at the state capitol. We have a busy agenda, so let's get going this morning. A couple of testifiers, please identify yourselves as we start testimony on the importance of dairy, and tell us who you are for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Ward. I'm with the Cooperative Network. We're a trade association that deals with cooperatives in the state of Minnesota, and we're pleased to partner with Minnesota Milk Producers on Dairy Day because Minnesota milk producers are the one that produce the quality, high-quality product. Cooperatives are the one that process it and make it into the cheese and the butter and the fluid milk or the milk that you're drinking here today. And it's good that cooperatives are a very important part of Minnesota's economy. Minnesota is the number one cooperative state in the country. But we're the groups that add the value to the milk that's produced by Minnesota milk producers. About 75% of the milk that's produced in the state of Minnesota is processed here in the state of Minnesota. So it's much better to have that milk stay in Minnesota, be processed in Minnesota, made it into product, add value to that product, and it's good for Minnesota milk producers. It's good for the Minnesota economy. Processing milk adds value to that milk, and it also creates jobs in Minnesota. And a lot of these jobs are, you know, they're not the old jobs where you're thinking of a guy with an oar steering way in a cheese vat. They're very high tech jobs. We process it more into fluid milk and cheese and butter that you know are very familiar with. A lot of food ingredients that the food processing industry uses come from dairy products. A baby formula comes from dairy products. A lot of medicines are derived from byproducts of dairy products. In some cases, even lately, we've been using a lot of road de-icer to get the ice off the Minnesota roads. That's a byproduct of the cheesemaking process. The brine from cheesemaking is used to de-ice roads. We're in the quality business. We process a high quality, safe, and healthy product. Dairy cooperatives in Minnesota take pride in the high quality products they produce every day. Access to high quality milk is very important to our dairy cooperatives. So, anything we can do to help the dairy producer expand his or her operation to produce more milk so that milk stays in Minnesota and processed in Minnesota is important not only to the dairy industry, but it's important to those of us in the processing industry. And lastly, cooperatives are owned and operated by the people that use them. So the profits of the cooperative stay within Minnesota. Last year alone, over $100 million in profits generated by cooperatives were returned to their members. So the money that cooperatives earn stays in Minnesota, goes back to their members, stays in the communities where they're located. So thank you very much for the time, and enjoy the high-quality products that are produced by Minnesota milk producers and processed by cooperatives here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Ward, thank you very much. Any questions for our first testifier? Seeing none, let's move on to our second guest today and identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, do you hear me well? My name is Dr. Marin Buzik. I'm assistant professor in the Department of Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota. I also serve as associate director of Midwest Dairy Foods Research Center. And to answer a question you may be having at this point, I'm from Croatia. This is not a typical Minnesota accent, I know. I've been asked by Minnesota Milk to prepare a few slides for your convenience to overview the state of Minnesota dairy industry. Over the next 10 minutes, I will attempt to provide a full picture and answer any questions you may have. We have prepared the handouts here in nice and color, so I hope that they have been distributed to all members of the committee.
Appreciate the color, too, so very good. Go ahead.
I'm big on color. Numbers can get boring easily, so I will not dwell on them. I want to tell a story today about structural change in Minnesota dairy economy, but just for the sake of completeness, a few key numbers. We have just short of 500,000 dairy cows in the state of Minnesota and produce over 9 billion pounds of milk every year. In last year, we produced 9.1 billion pounds of milk. Gross revenue on dairy farms topped $2 billion last year, contributed significantly to Minnesota economy. On the second page, I have mapped the dairy plants across our state. We have 56 dairy plants, a few less. This is numbers from 2013. We have 7 butter and powder plants, 8 major cheese plants where most of our milk goes, 18 artisan dairies, a night fluid, soft and frozen, so ice cream, eggnog, and similar plants, and one research facility on St. Paul campus. My boss, the Dean Brian Burr, prepared a report a few years back where he evaluated the impact of the dairy sector on the Minnesota state economy. He found that the dairy sector in Minnesota generates over $3 billion in direct total economic activity, that we use a major part of corn and soybeans produced in state, that each additional cow generates $7,064 in economic activity, think through indirect, through jobs generated in cheese plants and throughout the sector. And that the processing activity add $1.8 billion to the value generated on farm. Overall, just short of 15,000 jobs depend on farming, processing, and feed manufacturing due to dairy activity. If you look at the evolution of livestock sectors in Minnesota since 1990, and I have standardized that to make 100% be 1990 number, hogs are doing just fine. Chicken, beef, turkey, all sectors are either growing or keeping their own. One major livestock sector in Minnesota that has had issues, and I hope that later we have a conversation on how we can work together to address that, is the dairy sector. Dairy sector, number of dairy cows are just over 60% of what we had in 1990. Notice that, for example, hogs had 170% of what we had in 1990. So Minnesota is a good state for livestock, for animal agriculture, but dairy has its own challenges that I hope we can jointly address. On the next slide, I have the milk production since 1990, and the drop between 1990 and 2004 speaks to the picture shown on the previous slide. We have seen a rebound from 2004 through 2010, but for the most part, the production has been stagnant over the last 3 or 4 years. The story I want to tell today is one of structural change in animal agriculture, in particular in dairy. As we all know, farms are getting larger. We have a lot of farm exiting the sector, not just in dairy, but in other sectors as well. Other sectors have also seen more vertical integration than dairy. Take a look at let's take a closer look at what's happening in the dairy sector. On this slide, and these are a lot of colors here now, apologies for that, what you see is that the share of U.S. milk production that is attributed to farms of 100 to 200 cows has peaked 15 years ago, even more than 15 years ago, in 1997. Even farms of 200 to 500 cows are now declining in importance, and you may have been surprised by this, I certainly was, that even farms with 500 to 1,000 cows have peaked in importance, and today we see more and more milk nationally produced by farms over 2,000 cows. We will return to this after I review the situation in Minnesota. Now, if you look at how dairy families in Minnesota live, if you add together the farm income from dairy, from crops, and usually some family member works in town or off farm, if you add that all together, there is no imminent crisis. Nobody's on the verge of poverty. People work hard, and they are able to support their families. Even dairies 1 to 50 cows have slightly more money than U.S. median income. So there is no imminent crisis in terms of risk of poverty or hunger in the dairy sector. However, on the next slide, you see that we have exit rates. That means the percent of farms leaving the dairy sector every year. It used to be 8% in the beginning of the 21st century. Now it's 4 to 5% there. So why do we have this seeming discrepancy? On one side, folks seem to be living well. On the other side, we have dairy farms leaving the sector. To reconcile this apparent puzzle, take a look at first the statistics that speak to that and what farms are we losing. We are losing a lot of farms in the 1 to 50 cow bracket and 50 to 100 cow bracket. That's where we, over the last 10 years, that's where we have seen the most attrition in Minnesota dairy. To explain why this is the case, on the next slide I have only income from dairy. So if you can imagine a 50-cow dairy that does not grow its own crops but has to buy all the crops, nobody works off the farm, and they have to set aside money for reinvesting in their assets. When you look at the picture from this angle, you see that the dairies under 150 cows would struggle to continue this to the next generation unless they grow. The take-home message that I take from this slide is not that we don't need this farm. It's just the opposite. We value these people, and whatever action we take in the state, we have to keep them in mind and ensure that they have dignified retirement. The second aspect of that is that those that do wish to transition, dairy growth will be good for them. And we have to explore how we can help these farms reach 100 or 300 cow level or more so they can ensure dairy-specific income that justify next generation coming back to farm.
Mr. Bozek, just a question I have. Looking at the structural change in dairy farms, and we're losing the smaller ones at a greater rate. In some areas, robotics have made an impact in terms of a dairyman freeing up labor time for a smaller herd. They handle 50 to 60 cows. Has that at all slowed that decrease in smaller dairy farms, or isn't it much of a factor?
Mr. Chairman, we have over 2,500 smaller farms in these categories in Minnesota. I believe we have robots on about 50 to 80 dairy farms in Minnesota. Those farms that have implemented them, it has allowed the principal operators to stay in business longer. Even when their body starts failing them and they cannot milk on a day-to-day basis, robots would allow them to stay in business for 5 to 10 years more. However, robots are not yet at the point that which would make those farms much more profitable. I know of some farms where the next generation did come back home because robots allow them to have a more rich lifestyle, but it's not a game changer yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Pat will talk, the president of Minnesota Milk will address this more. I just want to say that and illustrate with one example how working together can make Minnesota a leader, not just in our region, but also nationwide. Dairy growth, the premise here is that dairy growth is good for entire Minnesota, not just for dairy farmers, not just for dairy processors, but also local communities. Think about the indirect jobs that the first testifier spoke about. Crop farmers, they have a better price for their corn, they have an opportunity for the third crop, and they also can get fertilizer for about 50 or 60% of what they would have to pay for commercial fertilizer. Growing Minnesota dairy locally also enables our dairy consumers to buy local food, which is apparently popular with a lot of consumers. And if done right, the dairy growth does not have to hurt environment. That's outside my field of expertise, so I'm happy to find any information for you that you request, but I currently don't have an expertise in that area. Overall, it is my belief that dairy growth would be beneficial for Minnesota economy overall. As a case study of how working together, the theme here is stronger together, how working together can put us back to national leadership, I would like to use the most recent Farm Bill. Some of you may be aware that we have a new dairy safety net It's called Margin Protection Program for Dairy Producers. Our federal representatives, in particular Representative Peterson, led the charge in bringing about dairy reforms. Our academic researchers, my group, I was part of that group, developed new tools to help producers understand reforms, and we partnered with Minnesota Milk and the University of Minnesota Extension to take the knowledge out to dairy producers. And I'm proud to say that today, of the top 20 milk producing states in the country, producers in Minnesota have adopted this policy the most as a core of their risk management. That's just the most recent example how working together from legislators to researchers to extension and trade associations can bring about change that put Minnesota in the national leadership when we decide to do that. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bozick. The question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bozick. The question I have, and I have no idea what the answer is, but I'm curious. When a classic big box moves into a small town, a lot of times the small retailers complain, or you see a falling off of the small retailers. I don't know if that's completely true either, but that's certainly my image. Is there something correlated there? What's the effect on the 200 cow dairy, the traditional family dairy, certainly where I live, of the large 5,000, 10,000 herd dairies? Is there any impact on their viability through the establishment of more of the very large dairies?
Yes,
Mr. Bozick.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, yes, the impact is there, and the impact is positive. To explain the causal mechanism there, in order for our cheese plants to be competitive, they have to be efficient. To be efficient, they have to be full. They have to utilize their capital 100%. Due to attrition in small dairy farms, our cheese plants have struggled to keep their capacity fully utilized. I believe we are approaching a consensus in dairy industry that we need large dairy farms to keep our cheese plants full and thereby enable family farms to stay viable, to have a market for their milk. That is one of the ways that large farms help the smaller dairy farms in Minnesota. The other channel there is that large farms also attract labor pools and specialized skilled labor that sometimes smaller farms then try to get from them. The more dairy we have, the easier it is to find hired hands for your dairy. And if you're the only dairy in a county, even if you're a 200 or 500 cow dairy, it's very hard for you to find labor. If you have more dairies in a county, then you have a labor pool, and it becomes easier for everyone to do their business. It also, the other effect is that the more dairy we have, the more equipment vendors we have, feed manufacturers, etc., all enables smaller family farms to stay in business and have their inputs lower.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, maybe I'm asking the wrong person, but I'm also curious about the impact of dairies on alfalfa. Alfalfa is an eco-friendly crop. And as we see, I assume that as we would see increased dairies, we'd see more alfalfa on landscape. Can you or someone else maybe later speak to that?
I would yield that question to my friend, Mr. Blumen.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may. Dairy cows eat a lot of alfalfa. Alfalfa and grass for dry cows and heifers.
Excuse me, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Pat Luneman, President of the Minnesota Milk Producers from Todd County. If we add cows to Minnesota, that will add alfalfa and grass to our landscape. You know, we will be having a more diverse agriculture because the cows are here. You know, that's not, when we add other livestock, that's not the case because they primarily corn and beans-based diets. But when you talk about cattle, either beef or dairy, there will be much more grasses and diversity added to the landscape.
And I would just add that driving around last summer after some of the heavy rains we experienced, seeing an alfalfa field where that soil is held in place, tremendous value to the environment and economically, the more cover crops, the alfalfa that we have, for example. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, on slide number 5, when you talked about livestock in Minnesota, you talked about the growth in hogs and the other, whether it's poultry or livestock, holding its own. Could you, inform us a little bit on why you think it is as far as the dairy industry and the decline? If everything else is growing, what's taking place in other states around us, and why isn't the dairy industry growing here in Minnesota?
Good question. Mr. Bozek.
Mr. Chairman, committee member, thank you for your question. I believe there is not just one factor there, but the top factors are that in early 90s when we recognized that something has to be done to turn Minnesota dairy around, unfortunately at that time there was no consensus along the lines of the previous question whether large farms help or hurt family farms. There was no consensus around that question. And there was a lot of pushback where our leading dairy cooperatives tried to invest and bring about the next generation of technology in Minnesota. We are past that point now. We now understand that better, and today dairy producers are proud to see their neighbors grow, or at least I believe that. I hope that's the case, guys. that's the way it should be. so that's one factor. We now understand that that we cannot fight structural change, that our consumers demand that we produce milk at affordable rates, which requires us to adopt the latest technologies, require us to grow. The dairy lifestyle is not an end in itself, the family lifestyle. We have to move forward. That's one of the factors that wasn't there in 1990s, and accounts for part of this drop there. Essentially, what happened over the first, in the next slide here, over the first 15 years of this slide from 1990 to 2004, what happened is we had a lot of attrition in family farms and not enough investment in growth. It's very hard to attract outside investors and outside farms to come to Minnesota. We upheld higher environmental standards. Our state is more friendly to the producers that are already in the state. Don't mean to draw comparisons with other states, but our strategy should not be what South Dakota is doing in trying to attract Idaho, California. Our strategy should be to encourage our domestic producers. The rebound we've seen is from the reinvestment and growth on a smaller number of larger farms. We just didn't have enough of those in 1990s.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the concerns people are concerned about is that with larger farms, the perception is there's additional environmental concerns, that large farms aren't as friendly to the environment and others as small farms. Is there any truth to that?
Mr. Bozek.
Chairman, committee members, you know, you can do everything in a poor way. You can have a bad marriage, raise a child in a wrong way. You can mess up the way you teach a course. There is nothing in this world that you cannot do in a way that's less than ideal. But it doesn't have to be that way. Nowadays, we have the technology, and we also have the sentiment. I personally know at least top 5 or 6 dairy producers in Minnesota. All of them want to be good citizens. All of them want to protect the environment. They're not here. They're not just gold diggers that will be in our state for 3-4 years, extract, and then move on. They want to be here for next generation. Some of them are the next generation. What we need is a partnership with state legislators and state administration for predictable, effective administration of environmental protection that will not induce uncertainty, but will provide certainty to the investment cycle. And then I believe we can have farms, large and small, that obey the highest environmental standards and deliver both rural development and environmental protection.
Thank you. Thanks. Mr. Bozek, I would just have to add that, we as a state play a role. I have to ask you, what about the University of Minnesota in continuing expanding this industry?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm glad you asked the question. The University of Minnesota has been a leader in promoting dairy development for over 120 years. One of our pioneers has walked on foot from township to township back in early 20th century, asking producers to form creameries and start selling butter instead of to induce secondary processing. We continue that noble tradition today. In fact, just this Monday, next Monday, we will have the Minnesota Dairy Growth Summit. We are opening that with a president of the university. I just spoke with his speechwriter yesterday, and he asked for input. You know, university takes its role seriously, and we are ready to contribute, and we want to partner with state government, with dairy producers, to do our share in moving this industry forward.
Thank you. More questions. Representative Lewick is next on the line. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the labor situation, what's the industry's perspective on bringing labor in from other countries? I've toured a number of small and large dairy farms. I had a small one closed down to me, my next door neighbor here, just in the past year. And I do see a lot of folks from outside the country, not just in what people might consider low-wage jobs, but I see people coming in and doing herd management jobs. And so I'm interested in what the perspective is on that, and why are we unable to produce that level of technical skill set here in the country?
Mr. Bozek.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I would like to make just a short statement and then again yield this question to Mr. Luneman. I'd just like to say that we are all immigrants. It's just that some of you came earlier than us, right? I'm just one of thousands of immigrants that contribute to Minnesota dairy industry today, a first-generation immigrant. But this question is outside my field of research, and I believe that in order for me to stay objective and credible witness here, I only need to speak to what I'm researching. Therefore, I propose to yield this question.
Mr. Luneman.
Mr. Chair, committee members, those of us that operate dairy farms are finding that it's very difficult to find labor, and I'll talk to you about a study that was done in just a couple minutes here that shows that one of the number one concerns of dairy farmers across the Midwest is where are we going to find the people to milk the cows and feed the cows and take care of them. So labor is a significant issue. Where the labor comes from is a significant issue. As we talk about higher technology, how are our workers going to be trained? And I will state that on most of our dairy farms, the pay levels are very competitive with other jobs in town. And I believe it's a good opportunity for many people that is not understood.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of a follow-up on that. I don't want to date myself, but when I took ag in high school, I found it a lot more pleasant to learn about chemistry and biology by talking about butterfat content, animal diseases, that whole range of things, soil sampling. As I look now, at least in a lot of our area, rural schools even, that stuff has gone by the wayside or it gets minimal treatment. And it would seem like those are the kind of things in high school that we might build a foundation, a general foundation that would cause kids to explore that industry. I would really be interested in either the gentleman's thoughts on that concept. Are we hurting ourselves at the very early part of a young career here by not focusing a little bit on that in high school?
I think that whole career choice is changing in our schools, but Mr. Luman, would you care to comment on it?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the whole issue of ag programs in high schools, FFA, we're not being able to find enough teachers to fill those roles. That's one of our primary concerns. Those that are coming out of our universities and colleges that are trained are going into the private sector, partly because of the pay, but also because there just aren't enough of those graduates. And so we, as an industry and basically as a state, need to do something about that and make some changes. One proposal that I would make is that there be some summer programs available for ag teachers so that they are employed 12 months of the year, thereby providing some additional income that may help match their salaries to the private sector. That's just one suggestion, Mr. Chair.
Very good points. And we do have some bills that I think will address that as the year goes on. But yes, the industry is exciting. Jobs are there, but we need to train more folks to fill those positions. So good points. Representative Bly is next.
Thank you, Chair. The last question raised an issue that is important to me, and I'll just comment on that because I've been trying to encourage, even in elementary schools, looking more at career and ag kinds of But it also has to do with the kind of pedagogy that you use that includes hands-on kind of learning, and we haven't really promoted that as we've been under this testing regime that looks mainly at math and reading. Not that those aren't important, but it forces schools to focus more on those skills rather than others, and I think it is very important that we begin that process of looking at those other kinds of things early on. But my question has to do with the comment about big farms versus small farms, and I guess I'm wondering, because looking at a number of issues that affect rural Minnesota and the movement of population away from the rural areas, I'm wondering, why is it better to have one farm with 5 to 10,000 cows instead of 500 farmers raising the same number of cows? I understand that your comment was that it's easier to implement the technology with a big farm, and maybe if we focus on that problem of trying to disperse that technology to smaller farms and incentivize farmers to have access to that kind of technology that makes their job more attractive to young farmers and all. My sense is that if we had more farmers in addition to more cows, that would be more positive than just having more cows.
Mr. Bozek.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I cannot speak to the normative aspects of it, what would be socially desirable from an economic perspective. What we do see is that there's something that we in economics call economies of scale, which simply means that you can produce milk cheaper on an operation of a larger size. Now, that is not a certainty, that is a statistical relationship. What I mean by that is that really well-managed family farms of 200 or 1,000 or 1,500 cows can do really, really well. It is simply the case that it's easier to do really well on a larger farm. For a number of reasons, you can there are labor-saving procedures. You can use different technologies that just would not be profitable on a farm of less than 2,000 cows, for example, or a little bit less than that. You just cannot use certain milking equipment, for example. They are designed for larger farms. So it is not the preference of myself or anyone else saying that one type of farm is good and the other one is bad. This is that's not up to me to say. Simply recognizing the pattern that in terms of returns to capital, it is more attractive to invest in a larger farm than a smaller farm. Again, this is not to say that we only need one kind of farm and can do away with the others. But rather, my point is to encourage growth on all farms that do want to entertain the next generation coming back in.
Representative Bly.
I guess I thank you, Chair. I'm thinking about, and this has to do with economy of scale as well, in a sense, and that is, having one farmer making a really good living, as opposed to many farmers who are making a decent living and contributing to the community and the vitality of the economy in rural areas, seems to me a positive thing. And I guess you mentioned that that's difficult for the smaller farmer to implement these kinds of technologies that would be time saving or work saving. And I guess that's the question. I mean, that's a problem. It doesn't mean that it's only solved by going to big farms. And I'm not saying that big farms are bad or good either. I'm just saying if our goal is different, if our goal is to say we want to revitalize rural economies, it seems to me it would be advantageous to be thinking about how do we assist those young farmers to make a better living perhaps or have a more attractive job. And if that were our state goal, we might operate differently than if our goal was to just have more milk.
Yes.
Mr. Bozek.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, in addition to being a cold-minded or cold-hearted analyst. I'm also a romantic, so I'm trying to. one of my pet projects going forward is something that I call Young Lions, and the idea there is to find whether it's 100 or 200 dairy producers around the state that have hunger in their eyes and fire in their belly, and they want to grow, and they should be the pillar of community revitalization that Congressman, you spoke about. Let's find what's troubling them. Let's find what hurdles they face. And if it's availability of capital, for example, if they just cannot grow fast enough, let's design new financial vehicles that enable them to pursue their dreams. We cannot stop or reverse structural change. We can tilt it a little bit to play along with our societal goals. And I believe the way to go about it is not to try to prevent those that want to retire from retiring, but rather to encourage and support those young lions that want to grow. And that's the way we keep the core of Minnesota dairy economy viable for the next 30 or 60 years. Thank you.
I would just add that we need all kinds of farms, all sizes of farms. As Representative Hamilton has stated so often, we're all in the same game together, so to speak. And when I grew up, I hate to date myself either, but we milked 15 cows, had 5 sows, 25 laying hens, and, you know, there was people on every quarter section of land. Well, those days, unfortunately, I think are past us right now. And you raised some very good socioeconomic issues, and I agree with the premise, but the realities of economics today, I think, dictate tighter margins, and you have to somehow at least get to some kind of scale where it's economically viable. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for presenting today. I'm an economist, but I've only had one egg or applied econ class at the U, but I understand economies of scale. Help me understand, I want to help small farms in Minnesota, and in my area near Duluth, there are a lot of young people want to get back to farming and the land and do community-supported agriculture projects. How can CSAs in vegetable production translate into milk production? Is that even possible? And the other question I have is there a premium for organic milk, and is that helping smaller dairy farms with their median income if they're going to producing organic milk?
Mr. Ludeman, I think you could handle this one.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I have a neighbor, neighbors, I should say, a couple that's similar in age to me, similar family. I milk 750 cows, and they milk 40, 50, 60, I'm not sure what level they milk at. But they went down the organic road. They run a wonderful farm, do a great job. They raise their family. Going the organic route has allowed them to provide for their family in a very meaningful way. The next generation is coming onto the farm. And so I think it does provide an opportunity for smaller producers in that area. And I would just emphasize what the chairman said, is that we need all types of dairy farmers. And the consumer is actually creating a market that allows for this. If the consumer wasn't wanting certain types of food, you know, we wouldn't be able to fill those niches. But the consumer needs to fill that. And then, but we also need to feed the masses, so to speak. And in our dairy industry, we believe that we can fill all of those roles. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Schultz, any follow-up?
Is there any equivalent in the dairy business to a CSA? Community-supported agriculture, but community-supported dairy? Maybe the professor can help answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, Schultz, we have 18 artisan dairies in Minnesota. Those are dairies of the size that you are referring to. And what they have done is they have branded their milk they produce on farm, maybe they're processing in to cheese as well, and they're trying to sell it through local markets, for example, Kowalski, Whole Foods, etc. So that's the niche that would be the closest to CSA that I'm aware of. So unless you want to go down the economies of scale route, you have to diversify and then make a brand of your farm.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, if we legislated
and mandated that every dairy farm had to go organic, what would happen to the organic market?
Mr. Bozek.
They would have too much organic milk. Mr. Chairman, committee members, the organic market is about 5 to 6% of U.S. overall fluid market. It is still a niche, even probably 10 years or more after the more than that, that USDA introduced their logo. Right now, organic dairy processors are looking for more milk. They do have milk shortage. So there is an opportunity. Now, unfortunately, it takes 3 years to convert from a conventional to organic dairy farm. And in the meantime, you incur all the higher costs but don't get the premium of organic milk. That's what's stopping some of more of these farms to go down the organic route. If legislators were looking for a way to address that, perhaps some support for the over the conversion period would help. But I'm really now thinking just as I go along. I didn't come prepared with these remarks there. Also, we have Pat's testimony. I just want to make sure that you don't think that I'm the only one talking here.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I just this was told to me by one of the farm group lobbyists that, you know, at one time all of our dairies were organic. It's not as though that, you know, that's something that is so foreign that it couldn't come back. But it's you know, the incidence of really farm chemicals that have changed that, and some people think that's a good thing. Some people think it's a real problem for healthy food. But so there's some debate about that. And, you know, in my reading of history of agriculture, we do go through periods where we have large farms and small farms. It does change back and forth depending upon the economics of things and what the government does to encourage or discourage. And, I mean, we do fund the kind of agriculture that we have now as a government. And I guess my line of questioning is perhaps if we, for various reasons, took a different tack and looked at how we might encourage or, you know, fund the farmers who I think do excellent work with whatever they're doing. I'm not trying to criticize farmers, but they have to make a living, and however they're incentivized to produce food, that's what we end up with. And maybe it's a debate that needs to happen more about what kind of agriculture we have. But certainly at one time, all dairies were organic.
And we do also have programs available for young and beginning farmers in the state now, loan programs, grant programs, livestock investment grant type programs available to all livestock folks. But there are programs available if they would like to avail themselves of those types of programs. Any other questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one quick question. Do they still price milk from Eau Claire, Wisconsin?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bozek.
No, they don't.
They don't do that.
It's different.
Okay. Further comments? Mr. Bozek, were you finished with your presentation?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. It was excellent, very concise, to the point, and thank you. If no further questions for Mr. Bozek, we have a next testifier again, Mr. Luneman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm Pat Luneman from Todd County, a dairy farmer there. And where I reside happens to be the district of Representative Mark Anderson from Lakeshore. So it's good to have you here, Mark, today. Mr. Chair, I have a couple comments here. Some of you are already provided with the goodies that are here, some string cheese and some milk. And I just want you to know, everyone in the room, that it's available to all of you, not just committee members. Minnesota Milk is happy to provide it to all of you here. I have more comments, Mr. Chair, but I would like to show the committee a video of our 2014 Producer of the Year, and it's Hinckley Farms from Chatfield, Minnesota.
Very good.
The fall corn harvest is in full swing, and with almost 4,000 acres of cropland and 400 dairy cows to work, a Minnesota farmer has to make every minute count. So a short break in the action is filled with lunch and a meeting of the board of Hinckley Holsteins, LLC.
No, I guess not in my wildest dreams. I didn't think we'd even be this big.
Bale and Marlis Hinckley built this successful dairy with 30 years of sweat and hard work. Sons Adam and Matt are officers of the family farm and will someday take over. Adam returned to the farm after going to college, manages the farm's employees, and is taking over the dairy herd. But oldest son Matt was determined to be a farmer early on.
When I went to kindergarten for the first day, I came home.
We were all sitting around the supper table, and we asked him how his day was. And
I told my mom and dad that I wasn't going back the following day. And they said, "What do you mean?"
He laid his fork down on his plate, and he said, "Well, guys, I've decided I'm quitting school because I'm going to farm with you."
Mom and Dad convinced Matt to finish high school. Then he became a student of the farm and his father.
Why? What did he teach me? Probably everything I know. You know, just take care of people and treat people the way you want to be treated.
As with most farm kids, both boys were driving a tractor before they were teenagers, and always watching and learning from their parents.
Well, from my mom and dad, I've learned quite a bit. As a child, everything from milking a cow, feeding a calf. Mom and dad have built a business from the ground up. This farm wouldn't be what it is if they wouldn't put their heart and soul into it.
This is something that Morris and I have taken and built on, and we just want to keep it in the family for them to build on and to keep it going.
Our plan for passing the farm on, the boys are slowly working their way into it. At some point, Dale and I will slowly get out of it, and the boys will jump in and take it over completely.
Dale and Marlis are proud of what they've built at Hinckley Holsteins. Like most dairy farmers, they had to fight to survive in the early years. What got them through was a strong faith and the inspiration that comes when you're surrounded by life.
If you've never experienced it, you really can't describe what it feels like, you know, to see a little baby calf and watch her, you know, as she's growing each and every day. I don't know, maybe it's the mother in me too, I don't know. It's a sense of pride, a sense of accomplishment.
At Hinckley Holsteins, steady growth has come from working hard and working smart.
We actually utilize technology from probably one end to the other.
LED lighting is used in the freestall barn to conserve energy and improve cow comfort. A robotic calf feeder helps to monitor growth and wellness. A tracking software helps the Hinckleys manage feed usage, shrink loss, and costs. Even the tractors and combines used to plant and harvest the crops are guided by GPS satellites to conserve fuel and prevent the overuse of fertilizer.
All these technologies help us improve our yield as a whole, whether it be on our grain side or on our dairy side. In order to get the most out of everything, we need to do the best management.
Both Matt and Adam are quick to acknowledge they never would have had this opportunity without their parents.
You know, I probably don't thank them enough for that, because now that has allowed me the opportunity and my brother the opportunity to be a part of growing a business and then someday to continue to grow on with our generations to come.
I'm very grateful that I can, you know, I did have the opportunity to stay.
We're proud of them.
Now that Dale and Marlis have set the path forward, sometimes they like to take a minute to look back. They drive the Ranger out to a favorite spot that looks out over the farm.
Well, it's kind of fun to take a ride out there and get away from all the hustle and bustle that's going on here and just sit back and watch.
We can see the whole farm from this spot. It's kind of a way to look back and say, you know, all of our hard work has paid off. And it gives you a good feeling that at some point in time, you can turn the whole thing over and it's still going to operate again. And it's through the family.
Very well well done.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, that's our 2014 Minnesota Milk Producers of the Year, and we're very proud of it. Mr. Chair, if I could, I have some comments here.
Go ahead.
In 2014, the Midwest Dairy Association, which is the checkoff dollars that all of us dairy farmers pay into, they're part of that, commissioned a study by Blimling and Associates to do take a look at how the Upper Midwest, specifically Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, Nebraska, compare to the other dairy regions of the country. It's a very in-depth look at our dairy industry. The book is about 2 inches thick, and so it covers so many different categories. And just briefly, I'll tell you, business climate is one, taxes, infrastructure, resources. And when the study was completed, we found that, yes, we're high in taxes, but so are a lot of the other leading dairy states in the United States. Our business climate is actually very good in Minnesota, but what really stands out is that we already have an existing infrastructure, and we have the resources. We have the land, we have the water, we have the feed right here in Minnesota. And that's why the Upper Midwest has traditionally been the dairy belt in the United States. So the study proved to us that this is a good place to have cows and have dairy farms. Now, you just looked at Dr. Bozick's presentation. I want you to know that our dairy industry is serious about growth. And so Dr. Bozick talked about the summit that's coming up this Monday at the University of Minnesota. And we're going to have, and we haven't done this in many years, but we're going to have the president of the university, Dr. Kaler, there. We're going to have the dean from deans of the CFANS, Vet Med, and Extension. We're having John Linkstein come in from Minnesota Pollution Control, our agency head there. And this summit is being facilitated by former Department of Ag Commissioner Gene Hugeson. We're very excited about this summit, but we hope to come out of the summit not with just a feel-good session, but actually some buckets of work on what we need to do in Minnesota to move our industry forward. How are we going to get on the right track? And Dr. Bozick has been part of this along with Gene Hugeson, and we intend to create some small committees from within our industry, working with the University of Minnesota, and hopefully even you, to try and get our industry to grow. Now, what are the challenges that you at the legislature can help with? According to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, we're down to 3,499 dairy farms as of January 1. Now, a lot of those are run by baby boomers just like me. Where is our industry going to be 10 and 20 years from now? Who is going to take over our dairy farms? So Dr. Bozick talked about the young lions. That's an approach that we really need to look at. But for you in the legislature, how do we help make that transition? Is it tax policy? Is it removing barriers? We need to think outside of the box on this idea. Possibly helping the sellers sell their farm through some sort of tax policy that makes it advantageous to the seller and advantageous to the buyer as they're coming into the business. So, and then we also need to remember that not all transfers are going to be family. I have 6 children, 5 of them sons, not a one of them yet, or my daughter, has stated that they want to come back to the farm. I don't know. The jury's out. I may have to be like one of my good friends who is here today, Bruce Stone, who had to look outside the family to find someone to take over his farm. The second area that we need to look at here is regulatory reform. We must improve and accelerate the processes for permitting while achieving high Minnesota environmental standards. We can do this. If a farm meets all standards for a permit, there should be a certainty of a permit. Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota are all ahead of us in this regard. And we have seen, through looking at a path forward and looking at the maps, we're seeing a horseshoe effect around the state of Minnesota. Wisconsin, Iowa, and South Dakota all are growing at a much more rapid rate. Well, they're growing, in fact, and we have not been. We've been the status quo. So we need to take a look at that. Also, the Citizens Board, which is the elephant in the room today, sent up another flare that Minnesota continues to be a flyover state and trying to attract dairy farmers from other regions. We have learned that we need to grow from within. Dr. Bozek talked about that. It's because we have been a flyover state and the other states have been more attractive than us. So we need to figure out how we can be fair to all parties involved. And the Citizens Board, we need to take a look at that and how they impact the permitting process. We need to create an equal playing field with our neighbors. And the first step that we need to do there is last year we talked about overtime thresholds and the 48 hours versus 40 hours, agriculture versus the traditional businesses in Minnesota. Well, I want you to know that the states around us all conform to the federal exemption of overtime for agriculture, which is that there is no threshold. We need to look, that's just an example of, we need to look at how we compare to our neighbors around us. Mr. Chair, you talked about the Livestock Investment Grant Program. I'd ask that you continue and enhance that program. It's working. Dollars are going out to help producers modernize their farms, and the program is geared to younger producers. In fact, I applied, but I was told that I wasn't young enough to really qualify. I didn't score high enough. So I speak from experience that it is going to younger farms, and that's a good thing. We need you to support a new independent production ag research fund. This is a new idea. We're asking for $15 million a year, or $30 million for the biennium, for new research, which would be administered by a committee and also administered by the Minnesota Department of Ag. When we look at research funding in Minnesota, we cut research funding over a decade ago, and we're not even close to where we were back in 2001, 2002. And Minnesota needs to fix that problem. We need leading primary research on our farms to move forward.
Excuse me just a second. Representative Schultz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point about research funding, why independent? Why not allocate more research funds to the university?
Mr. Chair, committee, the University of Minnesota has actually signed off on this. At least I believe they have. That's what I've been told. It happens to impact their budget, and it's better to keep it outside, although it may go to the University of Minnesota in the end.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that point, what the university needs is they need human capital. So you have the commodity groups that are willing through the checkoff dollars and others to help invest in the research, but we need the individuals to actually do the research at the university. We're working very closely with the commodity groups. A large coalition has come together, like the testifier was talking about, and we're also working with the university on this as well. So I'm going to be carrying a bill, Mr. Chairman. We're in the process of putting that together to address this. But you bring up a great point, because there are dollars, private dollars, that are wanting to invest in this as well. We need the actual people to do the research at the University of Minnesota and other places. Thank you.
Mr. Lindeman, is this outsider part of the proposed dairy research facility?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is outside of the dairy research.
Okay.
If I could continue, Mr. Chair?
Yep, go ahead.
Being that we're talking about the dairy research facility, that's my next topic. We do need a new dairy research teaching and consumer education facility in Minnesota. Currently, what's being proposed is a new research facility on the St. Paul campus. We at Minnesota Milk are behind that effort. We've been working with Dr. Brian Boer and others at the University of Minnesota. The committee that was set up by the legislature, the Dairy Authority, is behind this proposal as well. And right now, things are being looked at to see if we can even permit on there. As we look at this research facility, I need you to visualize high-tech, robotic milkers, information systems, sustainability studies going on here. How does the dairy impact the environment in its surroundings? Dr. Brian Boer has a great vision for this that we all share. and we need to get behind Dr. Boer and the university and get this research facility done. I ask for those of you that are on the bonding committee coming up that you put this on your schedule to take a look at this facility proposal this summer, and we may be coming to you next year for bonding. Mr. Chair, in closing, I'd like to quote another dairy farmer, not me. All dairy farmers need all dairy farmers. The question was raised before about large versus small. Our belief at Minnesota Milk is that all dairy farmers need all dairy farmers. Whether they be large or small, conventional or organic, we all fill a role in meeting consumer demand. We all help our dairy infrastructure, we help our rural communities, and we help our state's economy. And we must all work together, we must be stronger together to grow our industry. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you very much. Representative Lewick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a comment and a illustration. Representative Hamilton and Schultz brought up a point that I witnessed in the beef production area. A number of years ago, we attracted a world-class animal specialist, genetic and reproductive specialist by the name of Dr. Cliff Lamb, and he worked here in the state, University of Minnesota, for several years. He brought in a huge amount of that private investment research dollars on a scale that was mind-boggling. The problem, what occurred is our system could not fund him to the level that kept him here. So, to our regret in the beef cattle industry, Dr. Lamb eventually went to the University of Florida, and that was bad. But what was really bad is he took millions and millions of dollars with him. The industry follows the best and the brightest here. And if we can't keep them in our university system, then we are doomed. And it applies all the way across to agriculture. I mean, it was just it went those research dollars, and right behind him went that crop of postgraduate students and doctorate people that he was responsible to train. They went with him too. So you really kill the egg in the nest when we don't properly fund the university expertise. I mean, it was something that I watched, and we've got to fix that.
Point well taken. We have our marching orders, so we have some key positions and key jobs to do, and thanks for reminding us of those. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewick, so are you suggesting that we should fund the university so we can retain these professors, these leading researchers in the area, or do we need to fund these independent research organizations to help keep these professors?
Representative Lewick.
Excellent question. We have to ensure, everybody's got a recipe for how the university should spend those taxpayer dollars. I'm here to advocate for we need to spend a significant amount in the area of agriculture, and so I think that there's a huge competition that goes on there, and frankly we lost in agriculture and beef on that side. Everybody's in the world of the pecking order when it comes to funds, but it's a matter of what you make as a priority. And we're going to have a heck of a time ever getting that back. So I'm not, what I'm looking at is how we spend those dollars, because we lost one bright star there, but we lost the whole crop of bright stars, and some of them may have stayed in Minnesota. So it's more about how, not whether it's, and it's clearly in the university hiring system that, drove this. And not to say that he wouldn't have left for other reasons, but we did not attract anybody to fill that void, and that's a real problem. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's very complicated.
Okay, thank you. And I would just add on the dairy research facility, I think I carried that bill, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, and it's not moved as fast as a lot of us had hoped it would. There's been discussions going on, and hopefully now we can come to some consensus and get some bonding money and get this thing moving and to get it done, because I think the commission sunsets in 5 years, so the clock is ticking, so we need to move on that as well. And thank you again for the reminder. Are there any more questions from committee members or anybody in the audience who care to comment on our great dairy industry in Minnesota? If not, thank you very much. Thanks for the treats, the Minnesota Milk, or whomever gave them to us. And those in the audience, help yourselves to a glass of milk or a piece of cheese. We do have one bill to attend to. Oh, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And while we're kind of in a break between the two activities here, the very first day when we introduced each other here, I had mentioned I had served on the Livestock Siting Task Force that Governor Plenty had set up. And I served on that with Representative Greg Blaine. And Representative Blaine is here in the audience today, who snuck into the back there. And if you want to talk about champions for the dairy industry and for agriculture, Representative Blaine was that person. So I thought that we had the honor to have him here today. I thought I'd recognize that.
Stand up.
Thank you.
Very kind of you to say thank you.
Thanks to all that took part today, and we will do some house moving around here to get ready for our bill to be up. As Vice Chair Franzen will take over the chair seat.
Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 216 to be heard today, then re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
Representative Anderson moves that HF 216 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. Representative Anderson, please explain your bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and members. This bill has been around for a while, and it was the lofty ambition of those of us involved in agriculture to try to create some language that gives ag producers some comfort, if you will, when they would host activities on their farms. We think about talking about dairy today, breakfast on the farm, those types of activities. When a farmer really opens up his place of business and offers it to be available to the public to come in and tour facilities, learn about how you raise pigs, milk cows, raise cattle, things like that. So it's an effort to provide some comfort language and also to encourage more agribusiness people, agri-professionals, as we call them in the bill, to feel a bit more safe or comfortable opening up their mm-hmm. farms to the public for programs and such events at their place. And this is not a civil law committee. There are issues that will be raised concerning the legality, things like that, that what Minnesota statute currently does or does not allow. And we will get to those issues in further committees. We can touch on those today. But I would just like to say that this has been patterned after a Wisconsin law that was passed a year ago. It took them about 10 months to pass the bill in Wisconsin. And over there, folks seemed happy that the bill was passed and gave them some comfort. And the one thing I'll say about the legal part of it, this does not excuse a farmer or anybody if he knowingly allows a dangerous situation on his farm. If he has an uncovered hole or anything like that and somebody would get hurt, this does not excuse a farmer from those types of things. And I think the legal talk is wanton or negligent disregard of people's welfare. This does not go anywhere close to that. It relates to the average things that happen on a farm, the typical things that happen, and again, would not preclude a more serious incident. Hopefully wouldn't occur, but if it would, this does not give total blanket liability to a farmer or agri-professional. And again, that language does not make the danger known, and wanton or reckless disregard of people's welfare. I mentioned that this kind of comes after a Wisconsin case. 22 other states have laws similar to this, and it was tried in Wisconsin a couple of times and finally passed really very quickly a year ago, and they seem to be pleased with the results they have. And again, the owner must not have acted with the willful or wanton disregard for the safety of the visitors or intentionally causing injury or, heaven forbid, death to somebody who may come on their farm or agro-tourism place of business. Madam Chair, that pretty much is what I have to say. We have some testifiers to come up and speak, hopefully some before, maybe some against the bill, but we'll hear those testifiers.
Great. Thank you, Representative Anderson. We do have several testifiers who would like to speak to the bill. The first testifier, I do believe, is Tom Peterson from the Minnesota Farmers Union. Tom, if you'd like to come up.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. We strongly support House File 216 and appreciate Representative Anderson carrying this bill. As he said, we've been working on this bill for a few years, and as Wisconsin, I think he said, took 6 or 8 years. Originally, I had Representative Ron Szymanski as the author of the bill. He was an apple grower and was real interested in this bill, and then Representative Johnson's also been an author of the bill and is a co-author of the bill this year. As he mentioned, we've had a lot of interest, a renewed interest from our members, especially on the eastern side of the state that have seen it pass in Wisconsin, a lot of apple, different growers there. I just read in Wisconsin, the director of tourism, he called the legislation a home run on so many levels. Farmers who have talked to me about the importance of this bill include, as Representative Schultz mentioned, CSA operators. People, they have days where their customers come out and do weeding, or they visit the farm, and it's interesting to have different people out there. But ideas about they trip over the contour of the land, or they get stung by a bee, or a branch catches them in the eye. Apple growers, I mentioned that. I also have talked to a very large dairy producer who wants to, interesting just hearing the dairy discussion today, but a large dairy producer who wants to show how the robotics work and the carousels and everything, put in a room on their farm and has school groups out, and also contacted me about this legislation, said I really think this is a good idea and something that I talked to my insurance company, and they encouraged us because other states have passed this and looked at this. There's clearly a move in our state for people and in the country to learn more about how their food's produced. People are clearly more interested at all levels, you know, and wanting to be part of it or see how it's produced. And there's a lot of farmers are interested now if they can do that and get people out to their farm. And Farmers Union, we think that's a good thing. I passed around a letter from the grape growers that also is kind of shows support for it. We also, I didn't get it today, but the Fruit and Vegetable Growers of Minnesota also endorsed the legislation. And I don't know if there's anybody here today from that or not. MFU also believes the signage, as people see it, that'll be a good thing. That people see the signs when they come out to the farms and they'll say, yeah, I'm on a farm, this is a good thing. We've had a similar statute in Minnesota regarding livestock and horses for many years. So when you go out to a horse farm or horse events, you'll see a sign like this. And I know it is helpful. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card, as Representative Anderson said. You still have to have liability insurance. You're still going to, you know, be able to be sued for things that you're that are not inherent risks. And so on that, I encourage your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Next we have, I'm sorry, does anybody have any questions for Tom Peterson? All right, seeing no questions, thanks, Tom, for your time. Next we'll have Bruce and Sharon Johnson from the Minnesota Fresh Farms.
Madam Chair, yep. Agriculture Committee members.
If you could just state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Sharon Johnson.
I'm Bruce Johnson.
And we own Minnesota Fresh, LLC. And we operate a farm known as Minnesota Fresh Farm in East Bethel, Minnesota. And we thank you for providing this time to support, to voice our support for House Bill HF-216. We're located on Highway 65 in the northern part of Anoka County. Our farm has been in Bruce's family producing various crops for over 80 years. Bruce is a third generation farmer, and our son Luke is a fourth generation farmer. I'd like to make you aware of Minnesota farmers and ranchers' need for protection from liability for common agritourism activities. The risk of activities to visitors to farms and ranches is small, but it is real. This bill covers guests of the farm or ranch, whether they're paying or not. While most of our revenue comes from weekly produce boxes that people come to the farm and pick up or pick up at farmers markets, we also have a U-Pick operation for strawberries and raspberries. We also host an occasional wedding and a photo shoot. We plan to add fall activities such as pumpkin picking and small corn maids and pumpkin chunking, which is Bruce's favorite. We're still discussing that. Additionally, we have many non-paying visitors on the farm, such as students from the Academy of Sciences and Agriculture in Bad Ness Heights. They're a charter school that is highlighting agricultural activities. They come out to the farm and they help us a day in the spring and the fall in order to get a taste of agricultural life. And these are students that not are all coming from the rural areas. They actually come from the city's area, the northern suburbs of Minneapolis. We host international visitors through the Minnesota International Center and the U.S. State Department's International Visitor Leadership Program. Next week, we'll be hosting four visitors from Japan to provide them a view of family farming in the United States. We've had guests from approximately 15 foreign countries in the last 2 years. These activities, whether by visitors from Minnesota, neighboring states, or other countries, help to provide education about the importance of agriculture in Minnesota, as well as much needed recreation for those who may not have the privilege of living in a rural area. Agritourism helps promote tourism in general for the state of Minnesota. The agritourism bill requires farms and ranches to post a sign that notifies visitors of the risks of being on the farm. These dangers include natural hazards of the land, vegetation, and water, the behavior of wild or domestic animals, and ordinary dangers of structures or equipment. Ordinary just being on the farm and our operations. Most difficult for us as agritourism operators is to control the risk of a guest who might act in a negligent manner and that may contribute to his own or someone else's injury. That injury can occur by him or her resulting to follow the instructions given by us or by failing to exercise reasonable care while engaging in the agritourism activity. Paying and non-paying visitors are mentioned in the bill. The bill limits the liability we incur by having visitors on the farm, but it doesn't exempt us from responsibility for our own negligence. About half of the states in the nation already have similar agritourism bills. Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota are just a few. The bill is important to our farm because every time we open up our farm to visitors, there's a risk that they may stumble on uneven ground, they might be stung by a bee, or even receive a small wound while picking raspberries. These are seemingly small issues, but in today's environment, they can easily turn into a lawsuit, which would be worth tens of thousands of dollars or more. Insurance is already the most expensive cost on our farm, higher than seed or fuel, and a claim against our insurance policy would most certainly raise these rates. The bill will also reduce the likelihood of frivolous lawsuits, saving us and our insurance company time and money. Minnesota's farmers and ranchers operate with very tight margins to provide food and other agricultural products for the people of Minnesota. Agritourism activities are becoming a popular way for farmers and ranchers to add revenue to their operations and keep them in the family. At the same time, Minnesotans are becoming more interested in the origin of their food and are eager to show their children where food comes from. When visitors come to our farm, they appreciate the ability to taste a freshly picked strawberry, to learn about Minnesota's farms, or to sit in the sunshine as someone who is dear to them pledges their life and marriage. Passing HF 216, the agritourism bill, will reduce the risks that we are already shouldering and will make it more attractive for new agritourism active operators in the state of Minnesota to share the fruits of our land. I ask for your support of HF 216, and thank you again for the time that you have given us for this hearing.
Thank you, Bruce and Sharon. Does anybody here have any questions for the testifiers? Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say thank you for coming in and testifying. I'm trying to think of a question directed towards your husband because he's so reluctant to get up here. And he's like, you go, honey. You know. But, no, I simply want to say thank you. And you know, we have to do what you're doing. And I encourage others, farms, to do exactly what you're doing so that we can educate the consumer. I'm trying to come up with a question for your husband, and I'm struggling right now. But, no, once again, I say thank you. Oh, do you have a website? Do you have a website where we could go to and see what your farm's all about?
Our website is minnesotafreshfarm.com.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Does anybody else have any questions? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment, and we've got a nursery and orchard, apple orchard, in our area up north of Mille Lacs Lake near Palisade, Gilby's Nursery and Orchard, and they offer not just great apples, but they do a corn maze, they do apple pickling, they've actually got a walking trails amongst the orchard, and they brought to my attention that same issue you raised relative to insurance, and they make the point which you have already made that other states have got a statute in place that does I think, make it more comfortable for the insurance companies to cover this type of operation. So I also want to thank you, and just for the record, show that this issue is really a state issue. It's not a local issue, and it doesn't specifically involve livestock. It involves simple things like maybe getting stung by a bee, and boy, if you're in a strawberry patch, the bees like that too. But I want to thank you for bringing this to our attention.
All right, thank you, Representative Lewick. Anyone else? All right, seeing no further questions, thank you for your time, Bruce and Sharon, and thanks for visiting. Next up, we have Brett Olson from Renewing the Countryside.
Good morning.
Good morning, Brett. Thank you.
My name is Brett Olson, and I work for a nonprofit in Minnesota, but we do some work in neighboring states, and in the past have done some work nationally. But I'm here to support this House File 216, and thank you for inviting me. Renewing the Countryside has been working on agritourism and rural tourism issues for probably 7 years, and hearing from multiple workshops and initiatives that we've worked with other NGOs in the state, that this is a barrier that many family farms like Fresh Farm was just telling you about, that this is something that we're hearing across the board from the corn maze or pumpkin patch, which I think we all kind of see as sort of that gold standard of agritourism, down to things that you all probably have participated in, which is a farmer having a pancake breakfast, or people inviting their neighbors to hunt their land. These are types of agritourism. The state has addressed hunting on state land, for example. And we see this as sort of a similar type of thing that will help those family farms diversify their income streams. Currently working with the Department of Health and Department of Agriculture on an on-farm food manual for family farms who wish to do dinners on the farm or those pancake breakfasts, which goes into great detail. It's still in the works. We're still working with both of those agencies to hammer out exactly what people need to do. We want to, these farmers want to follow the letter of the law. They want to be responsible, but find that this is a barrier to inviting people on. It just makes them nervous, and rightfully so. Farmers are not your average business person. They are their farm, and having that at risk every time a wedding comes can be just nerve-wracking. And like they said, it won't stop them from getting the necessary insurance or the licensing or the conditional use permits, things like that. It'll just make those I hate to even use the word nuisance lawsuit, because I don't think it's a nuisance. I think people are genuinely sometimes hurt by that bee sting or something. But it shouldn't put at risk that family farm to help educate their neighbors and even paying or non-paying guests. So I encourage you to support the House File 216. We think it'll be a great opportunity and open up tourism across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Do any of the members have any questions for Mr. Olson? Seeing no questions, thank you for testifying, Mr. Yes. Olson.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Next up, we have Doug Busselman from the Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation. Doug?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Doug Busselman. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. We support the protections provided by this bill for activities related to improved interactions with farms. Minnesota Farm Bureau's counties are conducting a number of educational activities on an ongoing basis to help provide a better understanding of where our food comes from. Ag in the classroom tours, community breakfasts on the farm, and similar events help to reconnect consumers with agricultural activities and practices. The protections offered here recognize and alert those coming on the farm of the inherent risk potentially available because of being on a farm. Having said that, sub 2 of the bill spells out that the limits, that there are limits for these liability protections. Thank you for the number of legislators who have given their support for signing on to the bill. We also ask that same support from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Does anybody here have any questions for Doug? All right, seeing no questions, thank you for your time. Next up, we have Joel Carlson from the Minnesota Association for Justice. Joel?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I appreciate my annual excursion into the Agriculture Committee. Our organization represents individuals and businesses that are somehow injured through the fault or actions of someone else, whether it's a franchisee in a contract dispute or people that are damaged by drunk drivers. Those are the kinds of individuals that our organization represents. And let me just tell you at the onset that our organization and me personally are very big promoters of tourism in Minnesota. And it isn't just in Representative Marquardt's district where I hang out. It is all across the state of Minnesota. It's an industry that employs over 250,000 people. It has over $13 billion of gross sales. It generates $840 million of sales tax revenue to the state. Over 17% of all sales tax are generated by tourism in Minnesota. So it is a huge part of our economy and our heritage, and it has our full support. Now, having said that, I think as an organization and as legislators, I think it's important to carefully look at the consequences, negative or unintended, of legislation. And I believe this legislation is very well intended, but it has some unintended consequences. And just on its face, Madam Chair and members, unlike I think how some people read the bill, this language provides broad and sweeping immunity for the first time in Minnesota history to for-profit businesses that are inviting people onto their property. And it does not require any particular safety requirements, and it places in our view the responsibility for injuries on children and families and, quite frankly, taxpayers when you have an injury that is uncompensated from the person that caused the harm. And I quite frankly agree with Ms. Johnson, and if the bill addressed the owner's negligence for causing an injury, I think we would have an agreement on a bill. Unfortunately, the language of the bill just doesn't quite do that. You know, most of the issues in the bill, I believe, are best kicked around in the Civil Law Committee. But I've learned over many years that not coming into this committee or policy committees as bills move through the process, that you are left with the impression that there aren't concerns. And that is certainly not the case with this bill. And so that's why we provide this testimony. I want you to know whether it's a bee sting or any other kind of injury that may happen from an inherent risk of an activity, Minnesota law always requires us to assume the responsibility of our own activities. That's the law today, and those are not claims, Madam Chair and members. But we cannot assume all risks, and the law doesn't require us to assume all risks. We can't anticipate the bad conduct of others. Children in particular, which are subject to this bill, cannot appreciate the risks that maybe are presented to them, but yet they're treated equally under this bill as it relates to the immunity protections in the bill. In fact, we have just the opposite. Madam Chair, we have an expectation when we're invited onto a business's property that they will use the utmost care to provide safe food, a safe facility, whether they're serving us alcohol or other activities. We have an expectation that they'll use the utmost care, and this legislation, we believe, eliminates those requirements. And it moves the law in a fundamentally different direction than Minnesota law for the past 150 years. I'm happy to answer questions, Madam Chair and members, about the specifics of the bill. We're strongly opposed to the language that's in the bill right now. We've had several thoughtful discussions with the proponents of the bill, and we understand what they're trying to accomplish, which is mostly an insurance issue, which you're trying to address by taking away someone's constitutional right to a remedy, and we think that's just too big of a lever for what you get out of this. And quite frankly, if they weren't protected from their negligence, we would have, and I've testified to this before, I think the first time was when Representative Hamilton first chaired this committee, that gives us a closer connection to what the law really should be. And I'm happy to answer questions, Madam Chair, and but I hope that you will carefully consider the language of this bill before you eliminate someone's rights when they're injured, not through their own action, but through the actions or the fault of the business where they are going and paying to go. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I do believe that Representative Hamilton has a question. Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, you talked about the unintended consequences. What would be some of those examples, and have the other states that passed this bill experienced unintended consequences as well?
2 points, Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton. 2 points come to mind. I've read, I think, all 23 states that have passed their law, and this one is unlike anyone that I have read in other states. They all have different nuances, and this one, I think, takes all of the parts that give us the most heartburn and puts them into one bill. Many of the states do not protect the negligent conduct of the operator of the facility like this bill does. So if you look online, I believe it's on page 2, 2.14, when you see the word gross negligence, many states don't have gross negligence as the standard. They just have negligence as the standard. And with the unintended consequences of this bill are that you will have people who are injured who will not have a chance for compensation from the insurance policies that these businesses buy, because the actions of the owner or operator were not willful. They didn't take action to injure you. They were not grossly negligent, where they displayed no care for your safety, but they were merely negligent. An example are vehicle accidents, quite frankly, where there's a negligent driving. It's not gross negligence. There was one that happened in Maine not too long ago where three people were crushed between the hay wagon and the bus that was in front of them, killing one and injuring two others. That was not gross negligence. It was negligence. That would be protected under the current language of this bill. I believe that's not the intent of the author, and to me, that is an important unintended consequence. When you do something that you have a duty to do and you fail to do it, that is the problem with this bill. And actually, if you look at the bill on page 2, I don't think it's ironic. I think it's intentional. But the bill requires that I assume the negligence of other participants and that I act in a reasonable manner, but yet the owner and operator does not have to operate in a reasonable manner. That's what the immunity protection is. And that they're not that they are protected for their negligent conduct, but I have to assume the negligent conduct of someone else. I think that just turns the legal system on its head. And I met with Representative Anderson. I know he's well aware of the issues in the drafting of the bill, but those are some of them, Representative, that come to mind just off the top of my head.
Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had 2.14 underlined, and it sounds like when Chair Anderson was talking initially, and he was talking about the language there, I thought it was offering comfort to your concerns when you address the willful and the wanton piece of that. Is it just the word gross negligence that you have the most concern with? If that was addressed or changed, could we get your support?
Madam Chair, and Representative Hamilton, there are additional, that goes a long way, absolutely. There are some additional concerns about drafting in the bill that are unique. For instance, this describes as an inherent risk the conduct of the participants. In currently in Minnesota law, that is not an inherent risk. And so there are other more nuanced kind of questions with the drafting, but getting to a negligence standard and defining inherent risk to those things that are inherent to the activity gets us closer to language that I think many other states have adopted and will get us closer to supporting a bill, absolutely.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just... share a quick little story here, if I could, please.
Absolutely.
A quick little story. There's in the town in which I grew up, there's this hill that my grandparents went sledding down, my parents went sledding down, I went sledding down as a children, and all three of those generations of people, on one side of the hill, at the bottom of the hill, there was a building. My grandparents always sled away from the building. My parents did, I did. But then after I'd moved away, somebody sled down and ran right into the building. And that building had been there for generations. But because once the attorneys got involved and everything else, they closed down that hill so nobody else could sled down it. And it's just, it's frustrating. And here you have wonderful people that's wanting to open up their operation to help educate people what agriculture is all about. And they're simply looking for some comfort language in here so that they can do it. And we have opposition after opposition after opposition from the attorneys, and it's frustrating because we want them to have a viable business. We want them to bring people out to their business. And we're looking for language here that we can get support from you in order to do that. And you know what? I want to go sledding down that hill again. You know what? Sled away from the building.
Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you, Representative Hamilton. And members, we're going to try to wrap up as close to time as possible, so if you'll just bear with us. And then, Mr. Carlson, if you want to respond.
Madam Chair and members, I can tell you it is equally frustrating to the lawyers because the misperceptions about what happens in the legal system and what is in reality happening gives us heartburn, too. And I can tell you whether... you believe it or not, injury cases like that are down in Minnesota over 40% in the last 10 years. Out of our 5.5 million people, there were only 3,000 injury cases filed in Minnesota courts in 2014. So the reality and the perception are quite different. And what is frustrating to us is when we have an insurance problem where an insurance industry that doesn't want to write a policy that I think, quite frankly, places more risk on the landowner than what is actual, that precludes them from keeping that sledding hill open that I went to when I was, not yours, but the one in the dike in Fargo. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's frustrating us, too, because the risk and the reality do not match up, and that is a problem. What I want to protect is what our Constitution gave us, which is in Article 1, Section 4, and Section 8, we have the right for a remedy when there's a wrong. We think this legislatively takes that away, and that's what we want to be careful about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. And we do have Santo Cruz from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. If you want to come up, Mr. Cruz, and I believe you have something to say to the point that Mr. Carlson is making. Mr. Carlson, thank you for your time, and you raised some excellent points.
For the record, Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So I am a lawyer who is in support of this bill with MDA. We've historically proposed or supported this bill. I think the details matter. Some of what, and the last testifier and I have had many rounds on this particular bill behind closed doors, and we vehemently disagree on almost everything. But I will say this. The details matter. There is no remedy being taken away. There is an affirmative defense being granted in law. That's a very different thing. So let's say, for example, that you're sliding down a hill and you're injured. Now, that's something that would be covered by this law because it's inherent to the land. would the person who broke their leg against the side of the building not be allowed to bring suit because of this law? The answer would be no. They would file a document of an affirmative defense. A judge would review whether or not that is inherent in the activity of the agritourism. A lot of what's being thrown around are actually intentional torts. This doesn't even speak to intentional torts. Any type of assault from one person to another is not, this bill wouldn't even speak to it. Negligence is where there's already a duty relationship. And here we're talking about landowners. And landowners have duties towards the people on their land in three different flavors: trespassers, licensees, and invitees. Trespassers come in two different flavors, known and unknown. Someone you don't know is on your land, you have no duty towards. Someone that you do know on your land but is there without your permission, you have a little bit of duty towards. It's a very low threshold. Licensees are people that you actually invite over. It's a bad name because invitees are actually people that you charge them on. And you owe a higher duty to them. And then the last is customers. So when we go in the grocery store, how does the grocery store handle its risk with us slipping and falling when they're mopping? What do? They put up a sign that warns us that says wet floor. These are the signs that warn people coming onto the farm that says wet floor. There's a building at the end. A judge will determine whether or not that it's inherent. So there's no prevention of someone actually bringing a suit. There's an added protection for the landowner to say, I've met my duty. I've warned them. So one of the ways you can do this and litigate this without this law currently and have to spend a lot of money to prove this is to prove that you warned. This law puts it in place that the reasonable person standard, which all of negligence law follows a reasonable person standard, asks the question, did you do what a reasonable person would do? A reasonable landowner would warn when they have inherent risks. This requires them to follow the reasonable person standard. That is as common sense as it gets, in my opinion. So if there's something that is not common sense and is not inherent or is intentional, they would not meet the requirements for the affirmative defense. I just pulled it up while the last testifier was talking. There's currently 20 affirmative defenses in civil lawsuits that are available. But as far as I can tell, all of those apply to almost everybody but a farmer, and I'll tell you why. In Minnesota, we have Chapter 500, which requires that there is no corporate farming. So you're not allowed to protect your assets. You have to be personally liable in some way unless you get a commissioner's exemption. So we're affording something to the grocery store that we're not affording to the people who are filling that grocery store. And I think that's got to be said.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Does anybody have any other questions? No other questions? Do we have a discussion from, or I'm sorry, does anyone else wish to testify for or against HF 216? No? All right. How about any discussion from members? All right. Representative Anderson, do you have any final comments you'd like to make on House File 216?
I was going to say a lot of the things Mr. Cruz did.
Okay. So a simple ditto, is that what you're saying?
Anyway, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Time is of the essence, so I will renew my motion that House File 216 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 216 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and HF 216 is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. Representative Anderson, was there anything else you'd like to add to the meeting? All right, this meeting is adjourned.